This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, environmental policy advisor and conservation author Dave Dempsey tells us why states should step in and fill the void on Great Lakes restoration issues. But first, campaign finance analysts are projecting a very expensive year for political campaigns in 2018. Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger has been examining fundraising reports to see where the money is going in the state and who is giving it. Mauger will also be part of a forum on money in politics at Western Michigan University's Bernhard Center on Thursday. Craig Mauger joins us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So as you look at these reports, what are the early indications to you? Does this look like 2018 is just going to see a lot of money across a lot of races?
Yeah, I mean, there is no doubt about it. I think, you know, some people are saying that this will be the most expensive election that Michigan has seen. Others, you know, think it will be among the most expensive. I'm kind of trying to play it safe right now and say, you know, this will probably be one of the most expensive elections that we've seen. And you might say, you know, how could you say that this early? Well, there are a lot of indicators that we track to see where the money is going. And some of the top ones being there are four groups that are the primary spenders in state lawmaker races, so races for the state legislature, and those groups have stockpiled a record amount of money for this point in a gubernatorial election cycle. So with those groups having more and more money, that's going to drive up the cost of all the races for the state legislature. Another key indicator is the fundraising that's being done by candidates for governor already, and you're seeing that those candidates are raising a lot of money compared to where other candidates have been for governor at this point in the cycle.
When you look at those caucus committees that the parties established to try to win seats in the state House and state Senate, how much do you think that increase is being driven by new donation limits on what people can give to those committees?
I think that's a huge part of it. Your listeners probably know that in 2013, the legislature voted to double campaign contribution limits. So that was pretty late in the last gubernatorial election cycle that was done. So this time, these caucus committees that represent the House Republicans, the House Democrats, the Senate Republicans, the Senate Democrats, these are their, you know, main committees. These committees can now accept up to $40,000 a year from a donor. Before, it was $20,000 a year. So that's driving up the amount of money that they're fundraising. And I think just in general, there's more money flowing into politics. So those two trends, one being the doubling of the contribution limits and the overall increase of money is really driving up the activity. And what will this mean for people out there across the state? Well, people in Kalamazoo, this will likely mean that they're going to see more mailers, more TV ads in a competitive district like Margaret O'Brien's state Senate seat there. That race between Senator O'Brien and former state representative Sean McCann in 2014 was the most expensive individual state Senate race that we've ever tracked. And in 2018, it appears there's going to be a rematch. That race will be costly once again because the Senate Republicans and the Senate Democrats have a ton of money right now to invest in races like that one.
And as we speak right now, it's, you know, a year out from the 2018 election. Does it still look like we're playing on the same relatively small map, that there's only going to be so many legislative districts which are truly competitive, only so many state Senate seats for interest in, for example, where both parties are going to really put their effort, money, resources into it?
You know, in general, the map is, you know, the same as it was the past few cycles, that there are, you know, about a dozen or so state House districts and, you know, maybe a handful or eight state Senate seats where the money is really going to be focused. I mean, I would caution along with that statement that you never know what the election cycle is going to bring at this point. I mean, we're still a year out. You know, in 2010, a year out, Republicans weren't playing in certain seats, or those seats weren't even on their radar. But because it was kind of a wave election for Republicans, they ended up winning seats and playing in seats that they didn't expect to, you know, much earlier in the cycle. So I would just caution that it's early to say, but, you know, it is definitely not early to say that all of this money that's being raised by the caucus committees will be focused in on a small number of seats in the fall.
You also have a report on the current office holders who have raised the most money. That includes some people who are going to be seeking another office, like Battle Creek Representative John Bison. He's running for state senate. That should, at least in theory, be a more expensive race. Mm-hmm. There's also some term-limited people in there, like Attorney General Bill Schuette, but Bill Schuette is running for governor. One that stood out to me, though, was the current governor, Rick Snyder. He is term limited, so he can't run for re-election as governor. And as of now, he's not running for another office. So why would donors say they still want to give to the current sitting governor when, at least as of now, his next campaign is not imminent and perhaps there's not another one in his future?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's the governor. So, you know, donors' money tends to go to the top. You know, people who are in the highest ranking offices tend to have the larger fundraising numbers across their accounts. So there are a lot of people interested in what he does, for sure. He's been raising money through political action committees. So these are PACs that he raises money in and then gives the money to candidates that he supports. And then he also has a nonprofit organization called Moving Michigan Forward that's been doing a lot of fundraising. And it's, you know, it's not exactly clear where all of that money goes, what the specific expenditures are by that nonprofit, but that nonprofit has been actively raising money.
So after a couple of election cycles without any significant ballot proposals for voters to decide, there are some very active campaigns which are raising a lot of money. What stands out to you in terms of those campaign committees?
Yeah, I mean, I think what stands out to me is just the sheer amount of money that these ballot proposal campaigns have raised. We've tracked three ballot proposal campaigns that have already gathered more than $1 million in resources. So this is the early part of the campaign when they're just trying to collect the number of signatures that they need. Down the road, if these proposals do get on the ballot, there will be millions of dollars more likely spent on advertising and actually fighting out the politics of these proposals. But right now, these campaigns are raising a lot of money. And the ones I'm talking about are repealing the prevailing wage, legalizing marijuana, and implementing a part-time legislature. Those have been the three that have been most actively raising large amounts of money. Another proposal that would reform our state's redistricting process, they haven't raised the amount of money the others have, but they've had a huge donor base. I think we tracked more than 5,000 individual contributions to them. So there are a lot of ballot proposal committees of all types and all issues raising money right now.
If that voters, not politicians proposal to change redistricting does get on the ballot, will it stand as perhaps an exception to the rule about how groups need a large amount of money to pay people to gather petition signatures for a spot on the ballot?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the general rule, the general thought by people in Lansing is that if you're going to get a ballot proposal on the ballot in this day and age, you need to pay people to gather the signatures. There are exceptions to that. Some groups that, you know, have very active memberships and very active followings, you know, I'm thinking, you know, anti-abortion groups, school union groups have been able to, you know, gather the signatures without paying previously. But we haven't really seen of late a group like Voters Not Politician that is kind of just forming as the campaign is going on, be able to gather this number of signatures. So it's definitely one that a lot of people are watching.
Is the flip side of that perhaps the part-time legislature campaign, which has raised over $1 million, as you said, but they seem to be struggling to get the language right, to kind of get their legal ducks in a row in order to try and make a serious push to get this on the ballot?
Yeah, and they've raised a lot of money, $1 million. A large portion of that money has come from a nonprofit organization. They have been, of late, it seems, raising even more money and expanding their donor base a little bit. And it's unclear to me, and I think others, how close they are to the number of signatures that they need. But one thing that has been noticed is that an opposition group, Citizens Protecting Michigan's Constitution, has been spending a bit more money of late against them. So that could be a sign that things are getting more serious. It's unclear right now how close they are.
So how much of this money, which is either going to the ballot campaigns or perhaps going to the groups which plan to oppose these ballot campaigns, is secret? We don't know exactly who is giving the money that is being spent.
Yeah, I mean, a large portion, I don't have an exact breakdown at this point for the latest campaign finance disclosures, but for many of these groups take money from organizations that fundraise from other donors. So for instance, with the part-time legislature campaign, they've received a large amount of money, I think over $600,000 from a nonprofit called Fund for Michigan Jobs. So you can see in the disclosure that, you know, Fund for Michigan Jobs is supporting Clean Michigan, the part-time legislature campaign, but we don't know where Fund for Michigan Jobs is getting its money. And this is something that we've seen in Michigan and other states have seen this with ballot proposal campaigns for many years. You can follow the money to a certain extent, but you can't follow the money back to the source in many instances.
So as I noted at the beginning, you will be in Kalamazoo soon for a forum on money and politics. There's several of these events being held around Michigan. What's the goal here of you and the other people who are involved in terms of what you are hoping the public will take away?
Yeah, I mean, I think these events that will be in a few areas across the state are just about educating people about the role of money in politics, answering people's questions. You know, for our organization, the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, we're trying to show people the growing amount of money in our politics, how people can follow the money themselves and use the databases that are available to the public, and just basic levels, how to read a mailer that you get. If you get a mailer from some mysterious group in your mailbox before the election, how you can research where that mailer came from. I mean, these are the types of information we try to put out. Other of the groups involved, you know, have other takes on campaign finance and want to convey those to the public. So it's all about just providing a forum where people can learn about these issues.
Is campaign finance one of those areas where what we call citizen journalists can play a significant role, because it is, you know, public records that they can look at and see, you know, get an idea of where money is going?
Oh, that is exactly right. And I think that's a great question. We just saw municipal elections across the state where, you know, there were these races for mayor in many large cities. And what I noticed in a lot of these races that the traditional media outlets, you know, the newspapers, didn't do a ton of coverage of where the money was coming from groups playing in these mayoral races or city council races. But I did also see that, you know, you'd have bloggers or citizens posting on their Facebook pages research that they had done into who sent this mailer and who was funding the super PAC. So, I mean, that's a really interesting trend to watch, kind of the democratization of monitoring money in our politics.
Do you think the issue of money in politics, where it comes from, you know, potential conflicts of interest, those sort of things, is getting more attention from voters? Are they maybe giving that a little more priority than they have in the past?
I think so. I mean, I've seen polling that indicates that this issue, specifically, you know, anti-corruption and the role of large donors, are issues that are more important to voters at this point than it was, you know, years ago. A lot of times people don't think about money in politics as an issue. You know, traditional issues, education, the economy, things like that are at the fore. But with the amount of money that is pouring into these elections, Supreme Court decisions that have been made, some of the things that we've seen at the federal level with ethics concerns, I think all of these are bringing this issue out more, and more people are taking notice of it.
What's the next date that people should be ready for in terms of, you know, new reports, some new information, new data on what kind of money is being raised for the 2018 election?
Yeah, so for 2018, our next, you know, big set of reports won't come until late January 2018. Those deadlines always seem so far out, but they get here so quickly. So in late January, we'll get some more information on candidate fundraising and ballot proposal committee fundraising. If you are following a city election in your community, there will be reports for the post-general election period coming out, I think, in a couple weeks or so. So, I mean, there are always reports coming out, and there's always data that is accessible to the public on candidate fundraising.
Craig Mauger is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He joined us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Craig Mauger will be part of a panel discussion on money and politics on Thursday at Western Michigan University's Bernhard Center. Links with more information can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Even before President Trump was sworn in, environmental groups in the Great Lakes region and elsewhere were watching closely and raising concerns about appointments to key positions. Now, with some mixed messages, including a threat to cut federal funding for Great Lakes restoration, some advocates are looking to the states to protect the Great Lakes. Dave Dempsey is currently a policy advisor to the Traverse City-based group for Love of Water, or FLO. His long career in conservation and Great Lakes policy includes serving as environmental advisor to Governor James Blanchard in Michigan. Dave Dempsey is the author of 6 books on conservation and, I should note, holds a bachelor's degree from Western Michigan University. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
As we sit here and talk right now, how important would you say federal funding is to the Great Lakes?
Well, it is very important. It's been the catalyst for some major improvements and restoration efforts in the Great Lakes over the last 8 years. I think a lot of good has been done with the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. But I also think that states, including Michigan, have a responsibility to invest as well.
How much, you know, can the states reasonably do given that, you know, the federal government has, you know, more resources, more money? Most states have a requirement to balance their budget. You know, are the states in a bit of a tighter spot if they're going to fully fund programs in the Great Lakes?
Well, when you drop a budget, you have to choose priorities, and you invest in things you care about, and you don't invest in things you don't. So I think states have to reshuffle their priorities if they truly value the Great Lakes, and nobody more so than a Great Lakes state. It's struck me that Michigan and other Great Lakes states have been saying hands off to the federal government in terms of taking our water and shipping it elsewhere, and yet want federal dollars to protect the Great Lakes. I think that's a little inconsistent.
If the states are going to make up any cuts in federal funding, assuming they come at some point, should there be some coordination amongst the states themselves to make sure that the burden is evenly spread amongst states which have a stake in the Great Lakes?
I think that makes sense. And there's a precedent. Back in 1988, Michigan voters approved an environmental bond that included $25 million for a Great Lakes Protection Fund, and each state of the 8 Great Lakes states contributed to that fund according to the percentage of the watershed that they have within their boundaries. So, of course, Michigan contributed the most. The total raise was $100 million, and that's been put into an endowment that funds some Great Lakes projects. So I think the states ought to coordinate again. But in terms of more of a spending program, a direct spending, as opposed to an endowment fund.
Does that also, though, complicate matters that you have to get all the players at the table, get them to agree to, you know, X, Y, and Z if you're going to make it happen?
Well, it could. I'm not saying necessarily that Michigan should wait for Illinois, for example, to spend some money or commit some money to the Great Lakes before it does. I guess what I'm really saying is that the states ought to proportionally invest within their own boundaries in the Great Lakes. So Michigan should not wait for anybody else to take the lead. We didn't before, and there's no reason to now either.
One of the things you say on your blog is that advocates should be agitating with the legislature to pass a $2 billion clean water bond on the Michigan ballot for November of 2018, or to place it on the ballot for 2018 and then let the voters decide whether or not to approve it. What would that do?
It could do a lot. It depends on how it's designed. And I want to point out the history of water bonds in Michigan is very strong. We've had 4 environmental bonds since 68, 2 of which were devoted entirely to water and the other 2 of which were partially devoted to water. They all passed by 60% or more margins. In the case, what we need now really is a fund to do several things. We need to continue investing and upgrading our municipal sewage plants, which are in many cases getting to the end of their design cycle, their lifespan. We need to also invest in our drinking water supplies. The Flint catastrophe is unique in what happened there to lead contamination, but a lot of our drinking water facilities need upgrades around the state. And we also, I think, need to put some money directly into Great Lakes restoration, habitat, cleanup of sediments, control of invasive species, and so forth.
You noted that these have been put on the ballot before. They've usually passed with a comfortable margin. Do you think that would likely be the case again, assuming a competent campaign is run and properly funded, that sort of thing?
I think so. You know, times have changed, maybe in the sense that people are a little more skeptical of bonds or spending, but the advantage of a general obligation bond is that it does not raise taxes. It essentially puts first claim on existing revenues to pay off the bond over 20 years, usually. So it's not a tax increase. It's essentially committing a share of the state budget for up to 20 years to do some good things right now that will have long-term benefits.
So as of now, we don't expect that to be on the ballot in 2018. Maybe that'll change, but we do know that 2018 will be a pretty big election year. Michigan's going to elect a new governor. Of course, the state house and senate are both up. There will be elections in other states in the Great Lakes region. Do you see Great Lakes issues getting a lot of play in the campaign leading up to November of next year?
Yes and no. I'm a little skeptical because throughout my career, I've continued to hear from pollsters, especially that environmental concerns are very high on the voters' list and that environmental issues are going to be a make or break for candidates. It's almost never worked that way. Environment is something people care about, but it's usually the economy number one and then other things, and then environment is down the list. On the other hand, environment is kind of a voucher for a candidate's character. People want to know if, in Michigan at least, if the candidate cares about the Great Lakes. So I think it kind of, it's part of the portfolio, but not a decisive factor. But I do think that, in particular, statewide candidates for governor, attorney general, the other offices, need to take leadership on water issues. It's part of our identity.
You noted to Great Lakes Now that the federal government is always kind of susceptible to a big change when there's, you know, a new administration. That you get a new group of people who come in. They have different ideas, maybe view climate science skeptically, that sort of thing. Are the states somehow insulated from that or more insulated from that than the federal government?
No, I don't think they are, except in the sense that a bond issue, as I've been saying, is a long-term commitment. Once the voters approve an environmental bond, a water bond, you can't go back and say, well, we're not going to pay those bonds off. That would destroy the state's credit rating. But it would also break faith with the voters who supported it. So that's one of the reasons I think a bond makes sense, is that it locks in a long-term funding commitment to these things that our politicians say are very important.
So why do you think that's not getting a lot of talk right now? I haven't really heard anybody bring up the idea of putting a bond issue up before voters next year when, you know, some of the things you spell out there, it's passed in the past with, you know, pretty comfortable margins. It seems like it would, you know, address a lot of these concerns. Why do you think it's not getting much conversation right now?
I think because there's so many threats that people in Lansing are dealing with, in the environmental community at least. I mean, you've got, as I think you well know, there's rollbacks on invasive species ballast water control. There's a bill in Lansing to prevent the state from adopting environmental standards that are stronger than the federal government. There's a lot of defense going on, and I think it just takes, if people can find the time in the environmental community and hopefully the business community to start articulating a positive agenda, maybe that can get some traction. Right now, it's all trying to hold on to what we've got.
You recently wrote about Governor Snyder's legacy. He still has about 14 months left in office. And, of course, you noted that he, like other governors, said that he's not worried about that. He's just doing his job. But let's take your two arguments here that you make in this blog post, and we'll run with them. One, that he is concerned about his legacy, as most politicians are. And that, two, that his legacy could end up being tied to the environment. How much can he truly alter the trajectory of his legacy between now and January 1st, 2019, when he leaves office?
I think he can do a lot to take the bad taste out of the mouths of people from what happened in Flint, not to slight the long-term harm that's already been done to those folks, their health, for example. I mentioned in the post, or at least in other writings, that most governors during their time in office are held accountable for the economic performance of the state. But sometimes in the long term, something else is remembered. And that's the case of Governor Milliken. He left office when Michigan was in a serious recession, a near depression. Not his fault, but still, that's where we were. But I think people have forgotten that. And most who think about him are thinking more of his environmental legacy. You know, was responsible for a number of our laws, from our clean water laws to our wetlands protection. So I think historically that a governor can be remembered more for those things that endure than for those things that happen when they leave office. And I hope Governor Snyder sees that. Now, he's done some things that suggest a strong water interest. He had the state DEQ develop a 30-year water strategy, for example, but there's really no funding to implement it. This bond could help do that.
If Governor Snyder were leaving office right now, you know, what would be his legacy? Obviously, Flint would be a big part of it, but if you step back and look at his overall environmental legacy, how would you summarize it? Again, if we're talking right now and not theoretically about what he could do between now and when he leaves office.
Obviously, Flint is a major stain on that reputation and legacy. Otherwise, environmentally, I'd say he hasn't done harm would be his legacy. I don't think he's significantly worsened our position or undermined our protections, but I really don't think he's shown leadership.
As you look around Great Lakes states, do you see any sort of movement that indicates that, you know, maybe not just Michigan, but beyond Michigan, you know, the other states in the Great Lakes region, that there is this feeling that leadership has to come at the state level because the federal level at this point is basically, you know, going to take a much more hands-off approach, if not a more hostile approach than was taken during the Obama administration or even George W. Bush's administration?
Unfortunately, I think, in answer to your question, I think, and more generally, I think environmental issues have become really partisan. And the state that I think is doing the most on environment in our region is probably Minnesota. I lived there for a while, and there's a Democratic governor, and for a while there was a Democratic legislature, which did some really innovative things to strengthen environmental protection. One of those, by the way, was a voter-approved tax increase for the environment, 25 years, which was approved in 2008, and it's going to continue until 2033. So there's $300, $400 million a year for the environment there. Other governors, and it's mostly Republican governors in our region, really haven't shown a strong interest in the environment.
What do you think could change that?
Boy, that's a difficult question. I mean, in my dream world, voters would demand stronger commitment from our political leaders on the environment. But as we just discussed, it's not a top-tier issue for most. The other change, which we'd all, well, at least many of us would like to see, is a rebirth of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. It's easy to forget that the U.S. EPA was created by Richard Nixon and that significant environmental gains have been made under some Republican presidents. The first president, Bush, and 1988 actually came to Michigan during his campaign and made the initial promise of any president to start dealing with climate change. And that's sort of forgotten. That's almost 30 years ago, but I can recall it. So if that wing of the party takes hold again, that would be, you know, very desirable because we'd like to have the two parties competing to see who's strongest as opposed to who's weakest on the environment.
Dave Dempsey is currently policy advisor to the Traverse City-based group For Love of Water, or FLO. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon. Appreciate it.
Links to Dave Dempsey's website and his blog can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.